Would you believe this? Here we are, episode number 21 of Cinema Squabble.
We're legal.
Legal.
What's up with that?
Who are we? What do we do? Yeah, we could go to the casinos. We could we could drive this bus off a cliff and come out on the other end if we're provided wearing our seatbelts and everything.
That's Can I get off the bus first?
You could if you'd like.
Yeah, right. You're allowed.
That's all I want.
Okay.
Who are we? What do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics. I'm Adam Gerke. Joining me in studio, Tim Hall, Matt Oakes, Sarah Michelle Fetters. You know the bunch. And if you have more queries as to where we all come from, you can find it at cinemasquabble.com. Just click on the Your Hosts section and it'll break it all right down for you right there.
I think it's the first time we've had Matt and Tim in the building at the same time. This could be interesting.
Yeah, we'll this have is, to throw down.
No, all jokes aside, Matt's one of my favorite people, so I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and, I mean, you guys have been waiting for this day.
We have been
up into this point. So sure. Now, you know, now the party starts.
Right. Yeah.
Now that you're 21.
You're welcome.
Exactly. And if there's going to be arm wrestling involved, I just want to remind everyone that Over the Top, in the film Over the Top, that was because the thumb went over the top, and that was how he won.
He arm wrestled for his kid, which is really bad, by the way.
Yeah. Horrible
Canon
idea.
Films. Canon films.
So, lots of films to talk about this week. Got a lot going on from
Holy
last week
cow.
To talk about and a lot going on this week. This is a super strong week. So,
unlike last week.
Right, yeah. So
and likely next week.
Real briefly, if you're just joining us right now, which of course you are because we're only a minute and 30 seconds in here, but we'll be talking about Pan, 99 Homes, Bridge of Spies, Goosebumps, Steve Jobs, Crimson Peak, just to name a few, and a whole bunch of other stuff all packed in here, too, if we can squeeze it in with a shoehorn.
So, see what we can do.
Yeah. Getting right to it, Sarah, tell us about Pan, because that was such a winner last week.
It depends on what your definition of winner is.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much all definitions of winner would apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, that maybe. So, Joe Wright, the director of Atonement, the remake of Pride and Prejudice.
Hannah,
which is phenomenal.
So good.
So good.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Karenina from a couple years ago.
That was good.
Interesting. I don't know. I mean, it's
not his
up.
Best.
Yeah, not his best. But
not
it,
his
but,
worst.
No Pan.
But going somewhere. You know. So Joe Wright is a visionary director.
Mm-hmm.
He is somebody that really wants to put something up on the screen you have not seen before. And he takes J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan story and tries to tell an origin story of what happened to Peter before he got to Neverland and how he becomes the Pan.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows him getting kidnapped by the pirates, meeting up with Blackbeard, who has been living for centuries or whatever. It's kind of hard to tell for a long time in Neverland, inhaling pixie dust to stay young. And Blackbeard's played by Hugh Jackman. And it's their relationship throughout the film. We get Rooney Mara as...
She is
Tiger
awful.
Tiger Lily, I disagree.
She's unbelievably bad.
I would completely disagree with that.
Okay.
And then we've also got Garrett Hedlund as a young James Hook before
he
becomes
like this.
A captain.
He's talking through his smile the whole movie.
So this movie
yeah.
is spectacularly
bad.
Yes.
So,
but emphasis on the spectacular. It's this odd film that I'm going to tell you not to see, but if you do see it, you have to see it in a movie theater.
Really?
Visually, it is resplendent. It looks amazing. The costumes are phenomenal. It's freakishly well put together. The individual scenes in and of themselves are stunning.
So where does
but
the
no. totally,
where does the suck begin, though?
Hold on.
The script.
The script is
terrible.
Visually resplendent is...
Is true.
Fast exaggeration.
Not at all. This is Joe Wright doing David Lynch. I mean, David Lynch's Dune is a perfect companion to this film.
I'm going to have to disagree.
That's another movie that is a huge, colossal, freakishly expensive misfire.
Yeah.
But one you kind of have to see to believe.
This doesn't.
And this
it doesn't
rises to that same
good.
Level.
I think that there are elements of good in it. I think
totally
that it's interesting when they all start singing along to Nirvana and Blitzkrieg Bop, because you're like, what's going on here? And there's an element to what they're doing there that is subverting your expectation and bringing you something new. And then after that, I feel like it's just one long facepalm.
It is. Here's the problem I had. I feel like Peter Pan, Blackbeard, Hook, and Tiger Lily all belong in different films.
They do all. They're all in different films.
If no one told me that Hook was in the film, I would think they edited him in without his knowledge. Because he's this crazy, over-the-top, like, wannabe Indiana Jones, Han Solo type of dude who's annoying.
Yeah, he's not good.
He's not good. And I like him.
And that's not, you know, a lot of that, though, same with Jackman and Hedlund. I will politely disagree with you as far as Mara is concerned. I actually think she's very good in the movie, but
I like
she's in a completely different movie.
Yeah, she's
but
she's
with
not
Jackman
trying.
With Jackman and Hedlund, they are directed by Wright to go as far over the top as possible. You have this feeling as you're watching the movie that he was standing somewhere in the sidelines going, no, bigger, larger, and they're probably staring at him wide eyed going, wait, what, really?
That works with Hugh Jackman. I think that he's actually easily the most entertaining of the film. Like the way that he kind of jolts and jumps around the screen and like he's basically an acrobat.
Completely
and,
agree.
And that works, but
it doesn't work in the film.
No, it does.
And that's the issue, right?
I mean, there's no issue.
And the difference, though, between Hedlund and Jackman is Jackman comes from the stage. He comes from a theatrical background. So he can go this far over the top, and he can become this outlandish and still make it work. Hedlund's a more reserved actor. He's not used to doing this sort of thing, and it does show.
But again,
I don't think it's necessarily his fault. I think this, again, is the case of a director having complete, total power and making something to his vision that is just unwieldy and ungainly, but kind of brilliant to behold in a lot of ways.
We should talk about the sucking element more, because I feel like that has not been hit on enough.
No, I mean, the script is bad.
He's like taking bong hits of pixie dust, and they don't even explain it.
No, the whole third act is just kind of very much in line with this really mediocre CGI, big, large, giant finale.
But the CG
is amazing.
You know,
bunch of people on helicopters or heliships, whatever it was.
And it takes
Winter
him forever
Soldier.
To get to the Hive or whatever. And then he turns into Iron Man once.
It
like,
doesn't
all of a
matter.
Sudden.
It doesn't matter.
None
like,
of it matters.
You don't care at all. You just want it to end.
And they start burning people with flames. It was just too much.
Wow. So, all right.
It's a very odd.
Where do we sit on this one? Tim, how about you?
I'm going to go with the skip.
Okay.
Brian, who's not here, said it is a rental.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. Brian Zitzelman.
He's a fool.
All right. We'll put him on the outside.
He's a fool.
And Matt, how about you?
This is clearly a skip.
Okay. And Sarah, you were saying.
Well, it's like I said, it's a movie I'm going to tell you not to see. It's a skip. But if you do watch it, you have to see it in a movie theater.
All right.
Don't waste your money.
Don't waste your time.
Really do. It's
don't hurt your eyes.
Don't waste your time.
And this is a movie I guarantee you 20 years from now people are still going to be talking about.
No.
Just from.
You said that about Jupiter Ascending.
I do.
I don't think anyone's talking about Jupiter Ascending and has been like 4 months.
We'll see.
Okay.
Time
will tell.
Time will tell.
Now, 99 Homes, another film came out last week.
Very different.
This is a completely different scene, completely different mentality. Matt, tell us a little bit about this one.
Okay, so 99 Homes, and you'll have to forgive me because I saw this at Sundance, so I haven't seen it since January. But it stars, as Tim was saying, General Zod and Spider-Man. So we got Michael Shannon.
That's how I promote it.
The most recent incarnations of both.
That's what the world has come to. Everyone is just defined by what superhero they are. So we got Michael Shannon and we got Andrew Garfield. And 99 Homes is directed by Ramin Baharani. I think it is. Yeah, that's my Indian name. Or, I don't know, vaguely.
He made Goodbye Solo and At Any Cost.
Thank you. And it essentially tells the tale. It starts in a courtroom where Andrew Garfield's character is been sequestered to basically fight for his home because his home is being repossessed. He didn't make the payments, blah, blah, blah. And he gets sucked into the devious ways of this guy played by Michael Shannon, who is a business mogul, basically taking homes, flipping them, kicking people out.
Yeah.
It's a vicious cycle.
Real estate tycoon who's basically working the system, too.
He's a wolf of real estate.
Yeah, right. And he's working for the banks.
Sure.
I mean, we need to make this clear. It's set during the 2008 housing crisis.
In Florida, where
it
was a big,
just
ish,
the worst,
huge deal.
Worst place and worst time to be.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, the movie makes very clear that he was an upstanding realtor up to that point.
Was.
Exactly. And then discovered that he could work for the banks doing their dirty business for them and suddenly make a lot of money when his family was on the verge of being destitute as well.
Right.
So he was in a position because of what his former business was to being in the same shape that Garfield and everybody else in the movie was at. And he just flipped it on its head by doing some very unscrupulous.
Now,
SH, you can figure out the rest.
This film left that flavor in my mouth. I felt horrible after seeing this film. I was like, Oh, God. And not that every film has to be uplifting and smiles and everything's wonderful and Pollyanna attitude, but my God, talk about kicking the teeth please, sir, I'll have another? I mean, that's kind of what it felt like. Tim? Matt?
I didn't see it.
You didn't see it? Okay. Yeah.
So I think that this movie works most effectively when it's dealing in the emotional connections that people have with their property.
Yes.
Like seeing Andrew Garfield's family in the film being torn out of their house with just such cold malice from Michael Shannon's character. You know, he's basically just reading a script. You know, you have 24 hours to vacate the premises or you will be arrested in violation.
They got five
you
minutes.
Have three they minutes. Had five grab yeah. One minutes. Thing.
Yeah, exactly. They have 300 seconds before they're literally trespassing and they have the cops there and it's very, very dramatic. And I think that the first act is fantastic. The second act is really good and it kind of peters off at the end. I think that they kind of rushed their way to a conclusion, whereas this, it felt like an epic in the making. And then it seemed like, oh, 2 hours has gone by. Like we got to tie it all up in a pretty little bow, which is unfortunate. Because it's such a strong film other than that.
But, I agree. Yeah. It's really good. I mean, this movie is really, really amazing. But you kind of know where it has to go. Yeah. So essentially, Andrew Garfield's character, Dennis Nash, is making a deal with the devil. Michael Shannon's character. He gets foreclosed on. Mm-hmm. He and his family get evicted. But he discovers a way to get his house back by working for the guy that evicted him.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts learning all of the procedures and he's good at it.
The tricks of the trade are pretty filthy.
They're horrible.
It's a Faustian play.
Yeah,
it really is.
And that's exactly what this is. Mm-hmm. So you know where it all ends up, where it has to end up. And how it gets there is a little contrived, a little forced, and a little heavy-handed. And unfortunately, if you've seen Barani's other films, you could say the same thing to varying degrees about Goodbye Solo, especially about At Any Price. I think this one's far more effective than those other two.
Okay.
And it helps because Garfield and Shannon are spectacular. Shannon is as good as he's ever been. And I will sing the praises of 99 Homes all day, only because it is a reminder that Andrew Garfield is a fantastic actor.
And he hasn't done anything since the first Spider-Man.
That's right.
No.
Until this.
And so,
which is crazy.
And people need to be reminded that this young actor is
good. He does have this potential.
So I have a question for you who've seen the film. So can you fill this in for me? People who like blank will like this movie.
Italian neorealistic tragedy dramas.
All right. So from a more commercial standpoint, I think it it's kind of, I don't know, Wolf of Wall Street is my comparison. There's a lot of like fast talking and scheming and manipulation and emotional turmoil. So
it's nowhere near as funny.
I was just saying, Wolf of Wall Street's a funnier film. I actually laughed in that. There's like uncomfortable laughter, if any, in.
Is there the same amount of cocaine in the movie as Wolf of Wall Street?
Well, Michael Shannon sucks on an e-cigarette for pretty much every second.
It's a commercial for e-cigarettes.
Not in the way that it's shown in this movie, though.
Yeah.
I mean, the way he uses it, it's like a weapon. It's a
monster vapor. Yeah. So where do we sit on this, Matt? Theater rent skip?
I guess I'd say, it actually would play well at home because it's not a movie that is predicated on any big set pieces or whatnot. So I'd say it's the quality of maybe a theater viewing, but it would also work well at home.
Okay, so if we had to split, we can't split.
Oh,
votes
we can't
here.
Split. Votes.
No, so
I guess I'll go with a rental.
A rental from Matt and Sarah. How about you? You were saying.
Well, I mean, it's a theater.
Okay,
I mean it's. Yes, it'll play fine at home, but it's a fantastic film, deserves to be seen in the theater. And if you want to see a performance by Michael Shannon that potentially could get a Best Supporting Actor nomination, go.
Sure enough.
Long shot.
And I'm going to sit on the rental category on that one, too. I just because I felt so dirty afterwards, I just have a hard time.
You want to be close to the shower is what you're saying.
I do. I want to be able to vomit or something, too.
Please don't do that
in the
theater.
Right. Not in the theater.
Well, stay away from Victoria and Goodnight Mommy then as well.
Mm-hmm. Bridge of Spies, another one that came out this week,
as a matter of fact.
Comes out
actually
today.
Yeah, and big procedural.
I saw a movie.
You got a chance to see this one, too.
Yes, I did. Bridge of Spies is based on a true story. It's about a lawyer in Brooklyn named James Donovan, played by Tom Hanks, who gets recruited to defend a guy who gets arrested for being a Russian spy. named Rudolph Abel, played by Mark. Am I pronouncing it right? Is it Ryland?
Rylance.
So he goes through this whole procedure defending this guy, and then he ends up being recruited by the CIA to work with a swap for a U.S. pilot who gets caught over in Russia named Powers. And so he goes over to Berlin to negotiate this trade of spy and spy.
So between U.S. government and Soviet government. Mm-hmm.
And the East German government ends up getting involved.
And he's not associated with any government.
He can't be. And let's also not forget there's an American student who is caught in the midst as well that we're trying to somehow release or
spring.
Well,
it's easy to forget about him because he's kind of forgettable.
But it is important.
But that's also the point.
Yeah.
Because
it is.
Even though he's a forgettable character, he's not forgotten by James Donovan.
Everyone matters, Matt.
That's it. That's the point of the film as far as James Donovan's concerned.
And Tim, when we were walking up here, you had mentioned the fact that Spielberg sets up a scene in this that is traditionally Spielberg, and that's fantastic.
The scene at the end on the bridge. And what we were talking about before we started recording was, even though we all know the outcome of this film, whether you know the true story or whether you've watched so many films that you have an idea of where this film is going, Spielberg has this great talent of still building all this tension and drama in this scene that feels very human and very real and has this really crazy, like, emotional scope to it. And I don't know how he does it, but he's a master at it. At the same time, you pair him with Hanks and Hanks' ability to make you feel like you're watching. I feel like I was watching Donovan, even though it's Hanks' face and his mannerism, you still feel like you're watching this character who seems to care so much about everybody. And to me, when you pair those two things, you get a great performance and a great director. You end up with this really fun sort of procedural at points, but just a really fun film to watch.
And don't forget that the Coen brothers actually also wrote the script, so you do get
that
kind of
blew me away when I saw it at the end.
Wry biting humor every once in a while, and right. Some people apparently didn't find that consistent. I thought that the pairing of Spielberg and Coen worked beautifully.
Yeah.
I think that
was really good.
Yeah, because they kind of mellow the sentimental aspects that you sometimes get in a Spielberg film, and then you get Hanks, who's just inimitable in terms of being like a modern everyday man.
And to your point, for me, what jumped out to me was at the end, I'm not spoiling anything, but when you see Tom Hanks looking out the window and he sees those kids jumping over the fence, and he has that look on his face, and I was like, that's that Coen sort of influence in the film that you see.
Yeah, and
it's definitely Hanks in sort of Gregory Peck or Henry Fonda mode, where he is this all-American, stalwart, upright, upstanding guy.
He's a standing man.
Which makes his pairing with Rylance so genius in a lot of ways. The conversations that the two of them have, and that I think speaks to where you're talking about with the Coen brothers' script. Mm. The sly, subtle, almost dangerous wit that is there just in their conversations is quite remarkable.
Yeah, I love the scene where he tells him, "You never asked me if I did it." And they have this really cool conversation.
And we don't want to reveal it because it's a great conversation.
No,
but you're right.
It's a great conversation.
It's so good.
I really think also Rylance, folks aren't really going to give him his due out of the fact that his part is so underspoken. There's underplay. Mm. It's so under the radar, but it's one of the best performances we've seen by a supporter as well, out of the fact that he does so little but does so much at the same time.
Yeah,
I'd go one step further. It's one of the best performances we've seen this year, period.
Mm-hmm.
I think that especially in this film where you have a lot of supporting characters, none of them stand out in the way that Rylance does.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even come down to a screen time thing. It's just that he shines so brightly
that it's
hard to notice the rest of them. But then
I agree.
As you were saying, it is such a subtle performance. Mm-hmm. Like it's very deadpan and focused. It's very Coen.
It is very Coen.
It does make me a little, as great as he is, it does make me a little sad to see Amy Ryan, who plays Donovan's wife.
She doesn't get much.
Yeah. She gets this underutilized, and it's a very rote role, well beneath her talents. We're going to talk about her again in another movie where she's wasted a little bit later.
Well, it's before 1990. Women didn't matter.
But I mean, but also Alan Alda, who you think is going to have this really interesting, complex character,
he disappears after
the first 15 minutes.
He falls off the map, too, but we don't really miss him either.
No, we don't really miss him. I mean, and I will go with that. It's not as big a deal as far as Amy Ryan's character is concerned, but there do seem to be a few missed opportunities here and there where you would think like a director like Stanley Kramer, who used to do these movies like Judgment in Nuremberg and on the beach. Mm-hmm. He would take these huge ensemble casts, and even if you were in it for 10 minutes, say like Judy Garland in Judgment at Nuremberg, you would remember that performance for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Two other real quick things about this one that I thought were really spectacular. The cinematography,
yes.
The lighting throughout the whole film. You've got these really angelic things from time to time. And it was
always
really
dark rooms with the light just blasting
perfectly
through.
Yeah, that. And also the score, Thomas Newman. Now, Thomas Newman on this one kind of phoning it in. I mean, we're sitting there in the end of the theater going, sounds like Newman. Sure enough, there's his name, Thomas Newman.
It's funny, it's only the second time that Spielberg has worked with another composer other than John Williams, because John Williams on every single one of his films.
It feels like a John Williams
score. For The Color Purple, which was Quincy Jones. And that's the weird thing. It's like, it's so noticeably a Thomas Newman score, but it's Thomas Newman trying to be John Williams and failing.
Yeah, until the credits roll.
Until the credits, right. And the end credits is great.
Ding, ding, ding.
It's like, oh, what a great, Newman. You've got a great theme here. But it's interesting in that, also Spielberg, though, flipping that a little bit, hardly uses the score.
Right.
It's almost as if he's saying, I don't know if he's saying, I don't need the score, or if he's saying, I don't think the score is good enough for me to use.
One of the two, either way. So where are you coming on this, Sarah?
Theater. I mean, even with a few minor reservations, this is a stunning film, one of Spielberg's best in a long time.
Okay, Matt?
Yeah, I'd fall on the exact same page there. I think it's the best that Spielberg's done in a while. Definitely one to seek out in the theater. Sure thing for a handful of Oscar nominations. So.
Yeah. Tim?
Yeah, theater as well. I thought it was one of, I'm echoing everyone else, but one of Spielberg's best in a long time.
Sure thing. And I'm right there with you on theater as well. So,
quick question. Lincoln or this?
I'd go with this.
Yeah, British Spies.
Yeah, I like this.
British Spies.
I like Lincoln.
I'd go Lincoln, but I was just curious.
Yeah. Maybe Daniel Day-Lewis was a little bit stronger than Hanks would be, but
I think Lincoln's just a little bit stronger overall, but they're both
up there. Yeah.
Pretty fantastic.
Yeah, but Lincoln didn't have Tom Hanks stumbling around with a cold.
No, it didn't. Lincoln doesn't get robbed, does he?
No,
not quite.
Gets
shot. Doesn't lose his Saks Fifth Avenue jacket. Crimson Peak. This from Guillermo del Toro.
Yay.
Crimson Peak. Gothic horror. And this is one of those things where life imitates art imitates life. And we're basically given the aftermath of a family tragedy. And young Mia Wasikowska, who plays Edith, is an aspiring author. She falls in love with a guy named Thomas Sharp. And Thomas happens to have a sister named Lucille. Well, Thomas is played by Tom Hiddleston, and Lucille is played by Jessica Chastain. They all end up moving back to foggy old London town to Crimson Peak. And that
outside
is
outside of London.
Outside of London.
They're not in London. They're way outside.
It's way.
You gotta travel.
You gotta go by horse and buggy.
Yeah.
4 hours at least on foot to get to Crimson Peak, and that is where this house that it breathes. The walls bleed.
It bleeds.
Literally drips blood.
Literally drips blood.
Awesome.
Spirits are appearing from left and right, and basically what we've got to do is young Edith has to figure out what is this evil that is surrounding her before she becomes, I guess,
another specter inside the house.
Or becomes basically her book that she's writing the whole time.
Yeah.
There you go.
Crimson Peak is a gothic Hammer Films horror film for people that love old school gothic horror movies.
This is right. This is psychological horror. This is akin to the horrors that we would read about, say, Edgar Allan Poe, where it's not.
Well, and I mean Shelley and
they
get name dropped for good reason,
for perfect reason. And it's not the thing that's in the closet that leaps out to scare you, or the thing that cuts your Achilles tendon from under the bed. That's not what we're dealing with here. That's a modern day scary thing. We get the Guillermo take on this.
Yeah, and that works just so much better. Like, the fact that just the mere presence of the specters alone, it's not the mirror shuts and there they are behind him. You know, the jump scares, we've become so accustomed to them that we've become numb to them.
Mm-hmm.
What he finds frightening is like just the way that they move and the way that they're associated with their environment. Like, you have a ghost in one scene who just kind of crackles out of the wall and just moves so brokenly and inorganically. It's awesome.
And it is a very Guillermo movement, where if you've watched Pan's Labyrinth, totally. You've seen Hellboy.
Devil's Backbone.
All the creatures have these spindly fingers.
Yeah. Did you realize that two of the big ghosts were played by Doug Jones?
Same, right. same player from
Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy, all those.
So, okay, that would explain.
He's Guillermo's Andy Serkis.
He's basically Guillermo's Andy Serkis.
And
that's a good way to put it.
I'm doing spindly fingers here.
I'm scared right now.
Right. That's
are there any moments in the film that are legitimately scary?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would actually say no. I don't think it's a scary movie. I think there are unsettling moments. Mm-hmm. And I think there's what works so well about it is that the violence is very occasional. Like it kind of just hums along, and you would mistake it for a PG-13 movie until you get, you know, a skull bashed in, and you're like, whoa, that is really intense. Like,
but the thing is, Matt,
very graphic.
But the thing is, Matt, I think going on with that, I think you're spot on, because not only does that happen and is it so intense, it's organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Guillermo
has
a
great. You
don't feel like he's shoehorning in excessive violence, and that's his genius, what really works about it. Yeah,
exactly. I got to give a shout out to Jim Beaver. Jim Beaver plays Mia Wasikowska's father in this film.
I feel like we haven't seen him since Deadwood.
Supernatural. He was a regular on Supernatural for quite some time.
I don't watch that.
But he is so wonderful in the first 30 minutes of the film, mm-hmm. Making the one, I think, legitimate scare scene, even though you know it's coming. Mm-hmm. It is a legitimate scare scene only because of the look on his face when he realizes what's happening.
And we gotta mention the villains, both Tom Hiddleston and Jessica Chastain.
Really, you're gonna go there? You're gonna call them that?
I think from the first moment they show up, you know that there's something going on with them.
Wrong. Something is wrong.
It's not a spoiler. We can call them the antagonists.
How good is Hiddleston in this movie?
They're
both
brilliant.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
They're both so good. Yeah. Chastain is like she's done almost everything before. She really has run the gambit, but she's just so pissy in this.
Yeah.
Like every time she says something, it's like she's spitting a poison spitball in your eye. It's
but Hiddleston is
awesome.
Almost
sounds great.
Hiddleston's almost a combination of an early Vincent Price and Gary Oldman from Bram Stoker's Dracula, in that you know he's not probably a good guy. But there's
something
so tragically heartbreaking about him.
I thought you were going to say Loki.
No.
And that's,
oh
that's
my
what
gosh.
Makes the He's, romance element work.
It does.
Is that he is multi-dimensional. If he was, say, whatever the dude was that played 50 Shades of Grey, like,
oh, yeah.
I am intense. You don't understand how much baggage I have. That doesn't work. And his character doesn't go there. But that arrives organically from the scenes. We know that this is a guy with baggage. We know that this is a guy who is multidimensional, and that's what makes it, you know.
Mr. Gray, by the way.
Yeah, that was awesome.
So, okay.
But,
awesome.
I mean, but we got to throw this out here because it is sort of a quartet.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Hunnam is also in this.
He's fine.
How forgettable is he?
Pretty forgettable.
He's always forgettable.
It's, ugh.
But I feel like Guillermo's just doing him a favor, being like, oh, no, we'll turn you into a movie star, Charlie.
Because of Pacific Rim.
Okay. We'll keep trying. So Crimson Peak, Sarah, you sit on this one.
It's a theater.
Theater, right? Matt, how about you?
I would almost go theater as well, yeah, especially for horror fans. I feel like this actually targets a mainstream audience and entices them into the horror genre, which I'm always down for.
Right. And I'm with you on that too as well. So three theaters from us. And Tim, we'll have to get you up to speed on
that. I'll have to watch a movie one of these days.
Right. Seriously.
So jeez, Adam, that was our adult
horror offering.
Don't we have a kid horror
there
offering?
There is. Goosebumps. Now, Goosebumps, if you're not familiar,
familiar?
Well, a lot of folks are who are of the older generation.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys. Yeah. I read these when I was in kindergarten first grade.
These were scholastic
all
books.
I read.
Let's point that out right now. Scholastic books. This was the this was where you got the little thing at in school and they'd say, okay, check off the check boxes you want. You brought in like 75 cents and you got books for nothing.
Those
and it
times.
Was I did too.
You didn't download it onto your Kindle?
I suppose you could probably do that now. But these were books written for little kids or young adults to make horror.
Well
kind of encompassing
5th, 6th, 7th, 8th graders.
So encompassing a number of those.
Good job.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Encompassing a number of those books written by R.L. Stine. We've written this actual film that's directed by Rob Letterman to create the story of Zach, played by Dylan Minnette, and also what is Hannah is the daughter's name, Odea Rush. They meet basically as neighbors, and it's sort of forbidden love. They shouldn't be meeting each other because
how Shakespearean.
Hannah's father
recluse
is this recluse sort of Cerulean guard dog. Strange guy.
Is this R.L. Stein? Does he actually play R.L. Stein?
He happens to be R.L. Stein.
Wow.
Well, what happens is all of R.L. Stein's demons get released into the neighborhood, and mm-hmm. we've got to save
that
the world.
Bad.
Is that by an accident, or is someone purposely released demons?
Sarah describes this as Jumanji.
It is. It's Jumanji.
Oh, it's Jumanji.
It's Jumanji meets Scream, in that it is really the most meta kids horror film you've ever seen.
But the weird thing is, kids these days don't know Goosebumps, do they?
Oh, yeah, they do. You should have been at our screening.
Their parents are our age who are reading it to them.
Oh.
Trying to scare them.
But see, here's the thing. Here's what actually sold this film for me, because Sarah's right. This is, we were discussing this last night. There is good cinema and there is bad cinema. And I liken it to food. There's good food. You could have a kale salad or you could have French fries, right? Goosebumps is French fries. It's still on the menu. It's not nutritious.
Is kale salad that good to you?
No.
It's healthy for you.
But what I'm saying is it's healthy. And so the fries, not healthy, still on the menu, and still have a time and a place for everything. I think what sells this film to me is honestly Jack Black as R.L. Stein. Because he throws himself out so unabashedly, so goofy. He's such a ham in this whole thing that it's a performance likened to, say, the Robin Williams of the world.
How hammy is he, though? Like, is this Gulliver Travels?
That's what I was thinking. Is this
no.
Is this Gulliver Travels again?
No.
Okay,
no.
What? Okay,
but there is a heave-ho scene.
Liken it to one of his other performances.
No, I'm just saying, look, if we're going to liken it to something, it's School like Pan, like we just talked about earlier. It's like Hugh Jackman in Pan, in that.
But what Jack Black performance is it?
It's more Jack Black, like him doing a rock star kind
of
thing.
Like Tenacious D Jack Black?
Yeah, it's Tenacious D.
Tenacious D. I love Tenacious. School of Rock.
But, okay. So Jack Black is giving a hammy, over-the-top, affected, odd, off-center performance that he knows is a hammy, affected, mm-hmm. off-center, odd performance. And it shouldn't work.
But it
and
does.
Yet in the context of the film, it actually does.
Okay. Well, cause
especially
the movie
early
sounds
on.
Pretty dumb.
Well, but the movie. So the movie is from the story.
Adam likes it.
The story is actually a lot smarter than you think it's going to be. But mm-hmm. that has a lot to do because it's written by Scott Alexander and Larry Karazet.
Darren Lemke.
Well, he wrote the screenplay, and this is where we're going to have some issues.
Uh oh.
The story is from Scott Alexander, Larry Karazet. I can't remember pronounce his name, and they're the ones that did People vs. Larry Flint, Ed Wood, Man in the Moon. The screenplay is by Darren Lemke, and there is a very big imbalance between the idea of the film and the ultimate execution of the film.
What did he do?
Yeah.
Darren Lemke.
Fact checking you.
Yeah.
Don't you know everything,
yes.
Sarah?
Actually, he did. He wrote Shrek Forever After and Turbo.
Oh, God.
Turbo.
Yeah.
But there are redeeming characteristics here.
Okay. No, I mean, there are. It's the first half of the film when they're setting up this world. So the idea is all of the monsters are trapped in the original manuscripts, and if you open a manuscript, then the monster's released.
Mm-hmm. You're giving away
obviously.
A lot of
no, I mean,
so
but they
much.
Give that away. They do that in the trailer.
So
nothing, there's nothing there that's given
I'm
away.
I'm not seeing it
are
now.
There, are there any legitimate scary monsters that you see?
For little kids.
But the abdominal snowman.
This is young adult horror. This is scholastic.
Well, it is Jumanji. Yeah. It's if you thought Jumanji was scary as a little kid.
Was it supposed to be?
No. French fries, so, kale salad.
This is French fries.
Okay, so Adam, we're talking like extra crispy French fries though, right?
Waffle fries.
Like,
no, curly fries with extra seasoning.
Waffle fries.
So that's where I sit on it. So I'm gonna
go get burgers.
For me, for the young adults who like or are getting into horror because it's only PG, go ahead and see this in the theater, is what I'm saying. Sarah, where are you gonna sit
for
on
the
this?
Kids.
Well, no, so what I was gonna say is the first half's fine. The second half is just freneticism and special effects for the sake of freneticism and special effects. The adults are all stupid to the point of being offensive.
Mm.
And it just becomes really pointless as things go on.
Okay.
So I'm going with a skip, but yes, young kids are probably going to adore it.
Well, we're going to split that one right down the middle. All right. Well, so theater and a skip. Sarah, that brings us to Steve Jobs, which is the other monster that we've got going on.
Well, and Steve Jobs opens in limited release this week. Mm-hmm. It opened in really limited release last week in like four theaters or something like
and
that.
And made like $1 billion in every theater.
It opens in, I think, 66 theaters this weekend and then goes wide next weekend. But Steve Jobs is about...
Who?
Or what's the Mac
no, that,
sound?
Well, it's just a bum.
All right. Yeah, it's about Steve Jobs, the former CEO and one of the founders of Apple. And it looks at his life through three pivotal launches that he did of three different systems, two for Apple and one when he was not CEO of Apple. The next system, if anybody remembers what that was,
very few people do.
And yet, the next system, very, very important because of
it
what...
It becomes Apple.
Because it becomes Apple.
Yeah, my only familiarity with Next was when I saw that in the description of what this movie was, and I was like, what's a Next? Mm-hmm. And I looked it up.
So it's based on the book by Walter Isaacson. It's got a script by Aaron Sorkin, who... If you don't know who Aaron Sorkin is right now,
get out.
Then
stop
you should
listening.
Stop listening.
Turn this off.
It's directed by Danny Boyle. Again, if you don't know who Danny Boyle is at this point,
go see Sunshine.
What is significant about Danny Boyle? What is something that he does in all of his films?
He's sentimental.
Well,
he is.
Not only that, but he does. Danny is always particular about the cinematography
he's
work
optimistic.
He does. He always does something.
It's always
tricky.
Dreamy.
And he's always doing something tricky with his cameras, where he's either a micro camera or this or that, or he's changing shutter rates or all sorts of stuff.
There's a lot of like hallucinogenic elements in pretty much everything he does. And
here.
No. I'm not saying here. Like, take for instance, 127 Hours. Like,
right.
So good.
Somehow he's able. That's Boyle at his best. That's Boyle when he's able to take his theatricality and apply it to a template that, you know, a guy with his arms stuck under a rock for 127 hours ostensibly is a boring film, but he makes it magical.
But I would say this is also Boyle at his best because he allows cinematographer Alwin Kuchler to fit each one of these three product launches are filmed in three distinct styles and formats.
Yeah, totally.
It's, you know,
you get it. It's like grainy.
I think we're on
filmic
like,
at
and then
first,
the second one also is on film. And then the third one is total digital.
Yeah.
Super crisp,
very vibrant. It gives this movie a building visual elegance that you don't quite expect for a film that is basically all about people talking in back rooms.
And yet Danny Boyle can't hold himself back in a couple scenes. Like, will they be talking about, it's a spaceship. He's using metaphors to talk about the product launch, and in the background across the wall, you'll see like an actual spaceship launch going off, and you're like, oh, Boyle, like, come on, like, hold it together, man. Like, you're so close to the finish line.
So the core of this, obviously, is Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal.
Kate Winslet as Joanna Hoffman, his longtime PR and marketing guru.
Sort of his work
phenomenal.
Wife.
Yes, basically
his
work wife. Jeff Daniels as John Sculley, the person that he brings in as the CEO of Apple.
Phenomenal.
Is the one responsible for firing him.
And but father figure.
And also father figure. And then also Seth Rogen as Steve Wozniak.
The benevolent side.
Yeah,
of
exactly.
Apple.
Catherine Waterston gets thrown in here as Chris Ann Brennan, who is his... lover.
Baby mama.
Baby mama.
Say that.
It's the only way to say it.
And then we have three versions of his daughter, Lisa, who we see progressively age throughout the film. And it's if you just watched Alex Gibney's Steve Jobs documentary, you already know that Jobs never wanted to...
Not the best dad.
Yeah, was not the best dad. Never wanted to recognize that he had a daughter.
That certainly comes across in this
And that comes
one.
Across in this movie quite...
Oh, he's an SOB.
Yeah, he really is.
But that relationship ends up being very touching and very effective,
and I think
which is just odd when you think about where it starts out at.
I think this is really interesting because we do see Fassbender adapting the personality of Jobs. As Jobs gets older, with age comes wisdom, and he mellows a little bit.
But he still stays true to his core principles throughout.
Right.
So I have a couple of questions. First of all, how good is Magneto in this movie? And what's
good
the big... As someone who saw the other Steve Jobs movie...
Yeah.
With Ashton Kutcher, what would you say are the major differences in the film?
So the major differences
good.
Is yeah,
come on,
Jobs the first one 2012 right. or whatever, they started writing that when Steve Jobs resigned from Apple basically to fight pancreatic cancer full time. Cool. And that movie, although there are elements to it where they are making jabs at Jobs. It seems like something that he would look at and say, yeah, I approve of that. Mm-hmm. This movie, I don't think he would approve.
Because I do. I think he'd approve it.
It's nasty. He never,
It certainly doesn't let you feel good about
Steve Jobs. It's borderline libel.
No, it's not, because I mean everything they say in the movie really happened.
No, well, that's hotly contested right now.
Yeah. One of the authors was saying something like, this isn't the Steve Jobs that I was writing about.
That's
what you get with biopics.
But right? If going back to your question, this is a fantastic film. Okay. Just top to bottom, like the performances, the cinematography, the score. The score is amazing.
Yeah.
Daniel Pemberton's second awesome score from this year.
It's so good. It's probably my favorite score of the year now.
And Danny Boyle also always pays extreme attention to the soundtrack, not the score, but the soundtrack that accompanies his films. And that's always one of those sort of it's kind of like Scrubs always had a really good soundtrack to it, the television show. Danny Boyle does sort of the same thing with his films.
He's the Zach Braff of films.
No, I think you're legitimately looking at a film that you could say have three actors who could all walk away with Oscars next year.
Yeah.
Fassbender, Winslet, and Daniels could all win.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure Daniels will actually get nominated, unfortunately, because he's never been nominated. But if he does get nominated, he could win. Okay. Fassbender and Winslet both could win, and they would all three of them would deserve it. They are that good.
And probably the biggest highlight is Aaron Sorkin's script.
Right.
Sorkin is he's somewhat of a divisive character in that a lot of people are kind of sick of him because he does tend to repeat himself, not only the themes of his stuff, but he literally says the same lines. He like rewords them, but he has a way with words that just escape most modern script writers other than like Quentin Tarantino.
No.
He knows how to make a scene that's whip smart, that just crackles along, and for instance, I think that with this, like the script is 185 pages or something, and it's a 120-minute movie, so the characters are moving a mile a minute. You know, they're always talking, they're always conversing, and it's always very organic and moving the plot along.
Mm-hmm. A lot of wasted
I have to say,
movement.
It reminded me, you know, Sorkin's script reminded me a lot of a David Mamet script in that it's layers, it's complexity, and also it's speed. And it also reminded me in a lot of ways of a Robert Altman film in a lot of ways, in that everybody's always talking, and the language becomes the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's very little moments of rest.
So it's fast, iPhone 6S.
In stores now. Yeah, and
how much should we get for that?
Anyone that enjoyed The Social Network will find something that is similar, but it's the difference between, you know, the first iPad and the iPhone 6X now in stores. Because
Got $400 for that.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of similar elements, you know, a lot of Sorkinisms, but it is very much its own film. Yeah, it's great.
So, Matt, you're saying theater on this?
Oh, my God, yeah. Okay. 100%.
And Sarah?
Without a doubt, 100% also.
And Tim, we're trying to win you over because you haven't had a chance to see this yet? Okay.
I hate Apple. I'm kidding.
Right. Oh my gosh.
I love Apple. I just got my first iPhone.
Yeah. And I'm going
to
say theater as well. So three strong theaters from
thanks,
us
guys.
on the old Steve Jobs. Still a couple film festivals also going on right now, specifically the Seattle South Asian Film Festival actually kicking off right now.
As we're talking.
Opening night.
The 10th anniversary of this, and it happens to be the largest South Asian film festival in the country. So more information, you can find ticketing and all of that at tasveer.org. That's TASVEER.org. We'll put that up at cinemasquabble.com, and you can get the website right there and check out the schedule for what they've got going on. But apparently quite the lineup this year.
Just so you guys know, I was invited to attend, and I decided to skip it to podcast with you guys. So.
We love you, Matt.
And I got Sarah, the publicist for the festival, Sarah Huey.
Sarah's great.
She sent me a few links, and I actually did watch one of them, a movie called Under Construction. It's a film from Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. It's about a woman sort of looking at post-colonial reality. I don't really know how to put it, but
Okay.
That'll do.
But yeah, again,
it's really well done.
Tassvier.org, and we'll put the link up at cinemasquabble.com. Also, the Seattle Gay or Seattle Lesbian and Gay Film Fest wrapping up. Sarah, any other thoughts on
20th
that?
20th anniversary again. It's the final weekend. All the shows this weekend are at Pacific Place, so they've taken over two screens at Pacific Place. They have the new Kristen Wiig movie, Nasty Baby, premiering tonight or Friday. So when this is airing and while you're listening to it, go see Nasty Baby right afterwards over at Pacific Place. The closing night documentary, Out to Win, which is about gay athletes. University of Washington football legend Dave Cope is going to be in attendance, and he's going to be there talking about it. If you've never got a chance to talk to Dave, you should go. He's a hoot. He's a lot of fun.
Excellent. So, and what are you working on right now, by the way?
Actually, I just interviewed Mr. Cope for the Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. I also interviewed Thomas Berzuka, who is the writer-director of Big Eden, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary.
Wow. Okay. Matt, anything on your docket right now?
Anything on my docket? I'm escaping the country this weekend to go to Canada. Fun. So
take off.
So hopefully it doesn't rain.
You're probably not going to have any Owen Wilson problems then.
Well, I did live in Asia for a while.
And are you coming back?
That happened a lot. Okay. Like way more than you'd expect. Like, you know, a couple times a month.
Are you coming back? Are you going away?
We'll see. I'd like to leave that open ended for now.
Yeah. I'm with it.
That's fair enough. And Tim, how about you?
You know, got some reviews to post. I just interviewed Brie Larson, so I'm gonna post that soon. That was fun.
Wow, that'll really be rubbing my face in it.
That'll be at the People's Critics
happen?
Blog.
What?
Yeah, we
what?
Got canceled.
We got canceled on. Yeah.
But you listen, got. But you got Brie.
Wow. I only take.
Tim's got swagger.
What's been offered to me?
I know.
I'm
Tim
sorry.
Has the. He has the.
He's got the magic fingers.
Tim's got the connections.
Wow.
I wish.
All right. Well, in summary for tonight or today, whenever you happen to be listening, Crimson Peak getting 3 theaters from the Squabblers. Steve Jobs getting 3 strong theater votes from the Squabblers. Goosebumps splitting things with a theater and a skip. Bridge of Spies getting 4 solid theaters from the Squabblers. 99 Homes getting 1 theater, 2 rentals, and Pan getting 3 skips. And Brian Zitzelman, who's not here, says check that one out in rental form.
Brian.
I think it's safe to say that, though.
He's just Zitzelmaning all over
exactly.
that one.
Yeah. This is one of the best weekends for new releases we've seen in quite some time.
It
you've
is.
Got,
the,
you've got
yeah,
4 strong choices,
mm-hmm.
and Adam will tell you that you've also got Goosebumps, which is...
Still,
which
also
is good for the kids.
Adam,
still
fun
kids.
For the kids. Adam's got goosebumps.
Okay,
don't take
we're
it
running,
away from
we're running out of time on this, but Sarah, you also had the good question. Oscar frontrunner, best film right now, go.
That we've seen?
Yep.
Okay, if that we've seen, I'm going to say Spotlight is my pick to win the Oscar right now of stuff I've seen.
Okay.
Yeah,
Matt, how about you?
I think Spotlight is the one. I think other ones that we've seen that it's battling against, I think we got Room, Steve Jobs, and Bridge of Spies, I think are all pretty much Best Picture locks.
Okay. I'm going with Room.
Okay,
my
you're going with
film of the year.
Haven't seen Room yet. I'm going with Sicario right now.
Oh,
that's where I'm sitting on that.
So. That's a great film that stands no chance.
But it's still great.
Yeah.
It's my pick for the best. It's my favorite film of the year so far.
So, well, all right. Well, this has been Cinema Squabble. We thank you so much for joining us. And if you get the chance to swing on over to iTunes, give us the votes, the likes, the thumbs ups, whatever you can do to promote the good cause that we're trying to do here to encourage the discussion of cinema in Seattle. So much would be thanked. CinemaSquabble.com is where you can find us. Again, I'm Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Matt Oakes, Tim Hall. Thank you much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Woohoo!